Hi, this is Zoe Durand, and I'm a family lawyer and mediator, and you're listening to the Inside Family Law podcast. This podcast is presented by Mediation Answers in partnership with Artwork and Lawyer Magic. Over the course of these episodes, I will take you on a 360-degree deep dive into all aspects of the family law process by talking with some of the greatest minds in family. I'm hoping that through this podcast, we can really encourage interdisciplinary conversations and perspectives that allow us to go deeper into what is really going on in the family law process, and that also make us more curious in our approaches to family law and how we do what we do every day. This is Zoe Durand. I'm just here live at the Pacifica Congress Conference in Hobart, and I'm having a chat with Dr. Robert Simon, who has just been talking here. Dr. Simon, could you just describe what it is you do exactly, and then a bit about what you were speaking on?
Well, we showed a film that was about domestic violence in the family. And it was the story of a husband and wife and their young son, Tom. It basically told the story of how the husband in this case was controlling and abusive and inattentive and fundamentally unconcerned with the well-being of his wife and his child. The father himself, as it turns out, had been similarly mistreated by his own father, so it also helped to depict the generational transmission of this kind of intimate partner violence that we call coercive controlling violence. Ultimately, in the movie, the mother finds that she can no longer tolerate this. She finally finds her voice, and she stands up to the father, who then, sadly enough, kills her. So the movie is not a feel-good movie, it's not a happy ending movie, but it's a very profound and important depiction of what can happen in families where there's this kind of what we call coercive controlling intimate partner violence. And after the movie was screened, I was part of a panel that essentially answered questions and offered comments about issues with family violence in and amongst the kinds of families that we see in our work in the family courts.
So, I mean, what's really going on? I can just, and this might sound like a silly question, but what's really going on here? Like, people talk about, is it a gender thing? Is it is it an entitlement thing? Is it a lack of empathy thing? Is it an intergenerational thing? Like, what creates this whole scenario, like, dynamic?
Yes, to all of that. Let me say this: that coercive, there are multiple types or forms of family violence, with coercive controlling intimate partner violence being the most pernicious, the most malignant, the most pathological and intractable form of this kind of violence, and the perpetrator this form of domestic violence, has as their goal rendering the recipient feeling helpless, powerless, and dependent upon them. So it's like a perfect entrapment, psychological entrapment. And the way in which they go about doing this is multiple. They can be physical with their victim, it can be financial, it can be isolating them from their support system, it can be shaming and humiliating them, it can be sexual exploitation. When you ask about gender, that's a great question, because when you think about domestic violence overall, there is what we call gender symmetry. It's as often perpetrated by women as men, except in coercive, controlling violence, it is overwhelmingly male and female.
And why is that?
That's unclear to me. I mean, I don't know that we have a... I have not read any accounts of that that explain that well to me.
I mean, that sounds like a silly question, but I've always...
That's a great question, and people have ideas about it. I know that that's what the research tells us about the lack of gender symmetry. If you ask me what my opinion about it is, I think it has something to do with masculine... men being uncomfortable with themselves, some men only feeling capable and strong and competent if they're dominating and domineering. It in part is, you know, conforming to certain sexual expectations that are stereotypical. And I don't mean to perpetuate those stereotypes personally. And I think what's important to understand, at least from my perspective, is that this kind of coercive, controlling violence is really a powerful manifestation of the perpetrator's underlying inferiority.
Fears, maybe.
Fear, inferiority, lack of self-esteem. But the other thing I want to emphasize is that the perpetrator of coercive controlling violence is fundamentally a human being that lacks empathy. You can't treat other people this way. You can't treat them in a way to remove their agency, to remove their sense of who they are, to remove their sense of being able to act in their own life in an effective way if you have any shred of empathy for them, especially somebody that you have partnered with to make a life with. If you can feel for another person, you couldn't possibly treat them this way because your empathy would not allow you to. So it's important to understand that these human beings, these men, again, primarily men, really lack empathy. And even when their coercive, controlling behavior is not directed towards the child, although it often is, as a parent, they really lack empathy. Because they lack empathy, they really lack the ability.
You're saving the care of your child.
They can't safely parent, because one of the most important qualities of a good parent is empathy for the child. Empathy is how we help people build their sense of who they are and their self-esteem. So it's quite pernicious. And it's generationally transmitted. People who perpetrate it typically have been victims of it, and it becomes a template for interpersonal relations. So it requires a deliberate, concerted effort on the person who's received it in their childhood to stop it with them, to stop it at that generation. Mm-hmm. It requires...
Which takes self-awareness.
Excuse me?
Which takes a lot of self-awareness.
It takes more than that. It does take a lot of self-awareness, but it also takes great motivation and drive and usually some pretty... intensive and useful and helpful psychotherapy, some treatment for that person's own sense of vulnerability that they experienced when they were coming up.
And now, just a couple of words about Lawyer Magic, a one-day course on the secret sauce to law practice scale up. We demystify all the parts around being a lawyer that you actually need to know to thrive in law, but usually no one teaches you. The three pillars to Lawyer Magic are the law of attraction, being magnetic, branding, marketing, and positioning yourself as an expert, the honeymoon phase, drawing clients to you, networking, building referral chains, keeping the spark alive, keeping clients happy along the whole journey and getting paid seamlessly, but in a way that clients understand the value of your work. Nicole Evans said, Zoe and Roey were fantastic. They tailored this course around our firm and our needs. We all took away a lot of practical tips and new ideas to implement on a day-to-day basis. We believe the real magic happens by identifying what is naturally unique about you, including your special passions, and showing how to amplify and communicate this. Exhibit A, hopefully like I'm doing in this podcast.
I mean, how do these things, I guess,
Because usually, you know, it's someone, it's sort of like, can you cook a frog in hot water? I would imagine the dynamic in a relationship, it's not like you go on one day, boom, family violence. These things probably happen very gradually over time, don't they? Like,
sometimes yes and sometimes no.
Okay.
There can be a ramping up. But the other part of it is that the victim, part of the impact of this kind of violence is the victim feels shame and humiliation. So they're afraid to reach out because they're afraid to tell people around them, their friends and family, that this is what's going on in their life. They feel embarrassed about it and humiliated by it. And they fear that if their husband or boyfriend finds out about it, that they will harm them. So there's great fear of leaving because in reality, the greatest time of risk to the victim is when they leave. So when the victim finds their agency and decides, I'm out, that's when the perpetrator is most likely to be more toxic towards them. And in the film, it was when the mom found her voice and said to the husband, get out, that he killed her.
So how do we, I mean, that's an interesting question. How can we support, I guess, victims of family violence in that time when they're trying to exit the relationship? What are the things that can be done to make it less dangerous for them? Because it's otherwise they are in that cycle where they are trapped, you know, and it is that most dangerous time. I mean,
These are people that need to be able to leave and at least for a period of time likely be in a location where the perpetrator can't find them. Often the people that get out of the relationship will seek a protective order of some kind, and it may or may not work because often the perpetrators of violence don't find court orders to really be anything other than mere suggestions, and they're not, of course, their orders, but they'll violate them. So that's why, for example, shelters for victims of this kind of domestic violence are, the location of the shelter is not published, it's not known, so that they can, these people cannot be found for a period of time. And, you know, ultimately, sometimes the perpetrator will calm down a bit and maybe become somewhat less lethal. But remember, when you have exerted control over somebody and your goal is to control them and to dominate them, and they tell you that you can't, I'm on my own now, you feel humiliated, and the response to the perpetrator of domestic violence and that kind of humiliation is to double down. So it's quite a
dangerous.
It's a very, very dangerous cycle. There's something called the power and control wheel, which I would encourage your listeners to go look at. And the power and control wheel will show what the cycle of violence looks like. So after, an example of that would be after an episode of real violence, sometimes the perpetrator will express remorse and guilt, which seduces the perpetrator back into that. It's like the spider to the fly, right? Mm-hmm. Step into my web, and
it's
then the cycle repeats. Exactly.
And
the person really wants to be safe. And remember, part of this cycle of violence is not only creating a loss of agency in the victim, but dependence at the same time on the perpetrator. So you feel like you can't exist without them. They have the money, they have the access, they'll take your child away, maybe you'll be homeless, and that does happen. Where, you know, you go to divorce or you go to court and you try to extract yourself from this kind of person, the price that you may pay can be huge.
I mean, how do we, I guess, break these cycles? Or what can we do in society or law or any systems, processes, to kind of change these things?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I look at this on a case-by-case basis as opposed to a societal level because I really don't have
such a big question.
I mean, you know, my work has involved this one family at a time,
yeah,
one child at a time, one mom at a time, right? And so, first of all, I think at a societal level, we have to make the knowledge of and awareness of family violence common. it can't be, we need to remove it from being an ugly secret that's swept under the rug to something that everybody knows takes place and is willing to talk about. We need to help educate all of us about the signs and signals that somebody's in trouble, that somebody's struggling, and teach people how to maybe do a little bit of outreach to those individuals and offer them a hand. But on a case-by-case basis, it's a matter of making safe resources available to the victim and the children to get them out of the situation, and removing them from the sphere of the perpetrator. And that could mean, for example,
Some way for them to go and help them in that transition,
absolutely,
which is the hard, very, really hard part.
Absolutely, because it's at that moment of leaving that that victim knows they're at the greatest risk and they're the most afraid. And they are, in fact, at the greatest risk. Here in Australia, approximately one person per week is killed by domestic partner or former domestic partner. One per week. Now, I'm American. Our population is 15 times your population. Look at the numbers that add up. And now we're talking death as opposed to serious injury.
What is it? Do you know? I mean, it's all right if you don't. It's on a memory test. In America, what's the stats on it? Do you know?
What's the stat?
Yeah.
Well, it's... If you've got 28 million Australians and you have one person per week being killed, and we have 350 Americans, do the math. It's... it would be 10 to 15.
But I mean, is it about the same? Like, is
yeah,
it
it's about 10 to 15 people.
Okay, so it's a
week.
Similar kind of...
Yes, know. yes. Mm-hmm. And while the death is sort of, if you will, the marquee number, a lot
there's
of very serious injury.
Yeah.
And by the way, while when people think domestic violence, they often think about battering, hitting, injuring. A lot of domestic violence, even coercive controlling violence, doesn't involve anything physical. It's emotional, it's psychological, it's spiritual, it's financial. Okay? It's any and all tools that the perpetrator feels they need to use to make their victim dependent and helpless.
I got a question about, and this is a bit more US kind of based, where's the, like, I guess it's different, isn't it? Because you guys are different in every state. But in terms of what is understood to be family violence or domestic violence, like, is it understood not just to be physical? Is coercive control really understood in terms of the legal definitions?
I think we're beginning to get that knowledge filtered into professionals, let alone the society. I mean, I think a lot of professionals still don't understand that it doesn't necessarily mean battering. See, there used to be the term, like, battering was synonymous with domestic violence, and that's inaccurate. The majority, the vast majority of domestic violence is not physical at all. The fact, though, is that when there is physical violence, it is more likely male on female, and men tend to use more lethal forms than women do when women are the batterers. Because men tend to use more lethal forms. So the battering by men on women is more likely to result in serious injury or death than the other way around.
And now a few words about artwork, where we bring art to your place of work. As some of you might know, away from the law, I have pursued a passion for art, exhibiting in London, Sydney, Melbourne, throughout China, and at a contemporary show in the Louvre in Paris. I'm now sharing my love of art and creativity with workplaces. I'd love to hear from you if you would be interested in team bonding art lessons, curated pieces for your office, or making your next corporate event a showstopper with a piece of art created live for your guests. I'm also interested in any of the other ideas you might have about how to inject creativity into your place of work and shake things up, hopefully in a good way. The benefit of working with me is that uniquely I am both an artist and a lawyer, so I have an understanding of the law firm corporate events context and can chew the fat with your guests about law, life, art, and my creative process whilst I create your special piece for your firm. Bronwyn O'Loan said, "This was truly an amazing experience. We keep getting comments from those that joined us on our special evening about how inspiring it was to watch you create such beautiful art. The memories will live on in the artwork, which will be hung proudly in our meeting space.
And in terms of, I mean, we talk a lot about, I guess, you know, the victims of or survivors of domestic violence or family violence, perpetrators of violence. Like, is there much that can be done? Like, you know, like in terms of them changing. Like, you know, there's a lot of courses in family law that we send men to, like men's behavioural changes. Do you think those have much impact or some impact, or like honestly?
I think most of the, again, I'll speak about the United States because I don't really understand or know what is typically done here. In the United States, one of the things that is very common is that people who are identified as perpetrators of domestic violence are ordered into what they call 52-week batterers programs. Now, notice the nomenclature, batterers programs. They may or may not be a batterer. The truth of the matter is that the research does show that these programs are not particularly effective. That, in fact, there's some research to suggest that these programs may actually reinforce and entrench the battering, because it's essentially like asking the violence. There, I went and used the term myself, because it's kind of like you send this perpetrator off to a class with a bunch of other people who do the same thing, and it's like a peer group.
Oh,
and
that's fine. That's normal. They're all like, that sounds normal.
It's like higher education and how to be deviant. It's like when people go to prison, they often learn to become more sociopathic. The research suggests that the most efficacious forms of intervention for perpetrators of domestic violence is individualized intervention, emphasizing not insight, not self-awareness, skill building, knowledge of one's stressors and what tends to make one get triggered, knowledge of how to recognize that you're becoming triggered, what are your physical signs, what are your mental signs, what are your emotional signs, and mindfulness, staying anchored and present, and anchored and aware of your experience in the present. So mindfulness along with cognitive behavioral or dialectical behavioral therapy, but insight-oriented therapy, where you deal with your feelings, you deal with your emotions, you deal with your history. This is, the, you know, this is how I was treated. This is, you know, my story of my mother. No.
Family of origin kind of.
No. Very pragmatic, skill building, and awareness of one's own experience in the here and now. Mindfulness. That's what works. Better. That's what works better. And there needs to be motivation. Unless the person is sincerely motivated, they're unlikely to change. And sincere motivation is not escaping punishment. Sincere motivation is wanting something better.
Mm-hmm. I like that phrase, wanting something better.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it takes. So it's incredibly complicated because it's the great secret that everybody wants to sweep under the rug. You know, nobody wants to talk about it going on with them or in their family. And you know, I can't tell you how many cases in my life where, you know, I'm thinking about one case in particular, and that was a number of years ago. But the sister. A brother and sister. The sister was married. The sister had kids. The sister and her husband and kids were visiting the brother. The sister's husband got angry at the son and started to batter him. The brother kicked him out of the house, and his sister begged him to let him back. Begged him not to report it to Child Protective Services because she was afraid if he did, that two things would happen, that he would become more violent and she would be humiliated. That's what happens. So the humiliation piece is in part about how did I let this happen in my life, but it's also in part about it being learned that what's going on in your life is at variance with what's considered to be normal. So the more we're able to talk about it openly, the more we're able to talk about it as something that goes on in families, the less stigma might be attached to it, and the less that humiliation sting may show up.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you really very much. This has been a really, really interesting discussion. Thank you for presenting it. The conference, it sounds like it was very eye-opening. How do people access the film, or, you know?
They should. The best way to access the film is to get in touch with the film's... she's not the director. She was actually, I think, one of the writers, Shana.
Mm-hmm. From Voice of Change.
Yes, the Voice of Change. She's... Mm-hmm. Very interested in finding ways to distribute the film and get it out into streaming platforms, so that it, what she wants to do is to make the film available to increase awareness and educate people, in an effort to one person, one family, one child at a time, make a difference. That's what this is all about.
And how do people reach... You're from the United States. Where in the United States are you from?
Well, I live part-time in Southern California and part-time in Hawaii.
Sounds like a nice life.
Yeah. I'm a very lucky guy. But I have a website, and people are certainly willing to come onto the website. They can contact me through there. There's a phone number in there and an email response.
What's your website?
It's www.dr-simon.com. So www.dr-simon.com.
Okay, fantastic. If someone wants to talk to you, they might be interested in what you've talked about today or some other issue in relation to families,
My work primarily revolves around families involved in divorce and co-parenting issues and, you know, custody battles and things like that, so.
And I'm really glad, I have to say, that we interviewed someone with an American accent, because we're trying to say this is an international conference and you're the first one with an accent that's not Australian, so that was very good for the podcast.
You'll excuse me, but I think you have the accent.
What are you talking about? We're here in Hobart.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Inside Family Law. I hope you got a lot out of it and that it has sparked a lot of questions and conversations that you'll keep having with your colleagues in the area. If you do want to stay connected with me, then please reach out on LinkedIn. You can find me, I'm Zoe Duran, or you can reach me on Instagram at Mediation Answers. My website is www.mediationanswers.com.au. If you have any fabulous ideas for a podcast interview, then please be in touch with me. Also, if you would like me to cover your family law conference, for example, or any other conference or event, I'm more than happy to discuss if this would work, so please also do reach out. Thanks very much, and I hope you listen in next time.